All right, thanks everyone for spending a little of your time with us. I wish I could walk around. I teach. I hate to be confined behind this, so if I look like a trapped but caged bear, it's because I want to move away from this microphone. But I want to pick off where Sam left off and talk about where could this microtopography have come from that we see in this kind of honeycomb network. This, you can see the white borders of these polygons. Where could this have come from? And how do we see that reflected in today's soils on the modern landscape? So Sam mentioned what sodium-affected soils were. There are 9 series we map in Illinois. If we look at where they occur geographically, it's interesting that there's one specific physiographic region that they're almost all in. There's a couple outliers, but they're almost all in this area we call the Springfield Plain. And I'll talk a little bit about the stratigraphy there in a second. One of the interesting things about the Springfield Plain is Peter Jacobs and I refer to this area in Illinois as the billiard table. It's like the southern high plains. It is flat, flat, flat. I mean, if you think it's flat in northern Illinois or central Iowa, you've not been down to the Springfield Plain. It is just tabletop flat. And here's an area of sass, a narrow area right through here that we'll look at again. So we've got this really low relief, relatively flat landscape. If we look at the geology down there, Sam gave you a little intro here, but the key part of the end of the story is going to be the location of the Wisconsin episode segment of the Laurentide Ice Sheet. It turns out this is related, well, we think it's related to paraglacial climate and landscape modification during the time ice occupies the Lake Michigan lobe area, and shortly after that as it's melting back. So if we come down to where these soils occur, they're out here on the Illinois and Till Plain that's less covered, as Sam mentioned. A little review again, stratigraphy-wise, we have the Peoria silt over the Roxana silt, and some of the Roxana is colluvial in nature. Sometimes there's a Farmdale geosol in it, sometimes there's not. The Farmdale is not an important part of this story. The Sangamon is in the upper parts of the Illinois and diamictons that are there. It's very well developed in this part of the world. As Sam mentioned, the modern soil often extends down through the Peoria, the Roxana, and into the Sangamon. So we've got a welded profile in many of these soils. Sam also emphasized the 1 to 2 meters of less thickness. If we go off to the west of where the sass occurs, we start getting into the thicker less, and we start getting into more dissected landscapes, and we run out of it. So something is different about this soil geographic area than where the sass occurs. So Sam threw out the question, why? Why on this relatively low relief planar landscape do we have this real intricate assemblage of sass and non-sass soils? Well, it's got to do with the Sangamon geosol, and it's got to do with the loess, and it's got to do with what happened during the Wisconsin episode. So there's a little bit of sass, again, out on the Springfield Plain. Sam mentioned, I need a source of microtopography. Where could it have come from? So my question is there some geomorphic process or set of processes that could have modified this landscape to allow the water that's the fuel to drive pedogenesis to alter these soils during the late Pleistocene and Holocene? All right, so let's go look at some of these areas. There's what Hilt and I call reverse pattern ground, and I'll show you why we call it reversed in a second. But hopefully everybody can see the white polygonal pattern. So here's some polygons right here. And that's where some of the sass soils occur. Now, one thing I'll mention, and I'll emphasize this again in the concluding slide, is this is one pathway. Not all the sass soils are related to these processes, but some of them we think are. So what do I mean by reverse pattern ground? Well, if there's any students out there, you never know what you're going to be doing 10 or 15 or 20 years from now and who you're going to be working with, because what I'm working on now goes back to my master's degree back in the late 80s, early 90s at The Ohio State University. And what I looked at there was some pattern ground, and I actually worked with Hilt while he was at Illinois. He wasn't on my committee, but we had this overlapping interest, and we ran into one another on a field trip, kind of like Sam and Hilt stumbled across one another. Well, Hilt and I did the same thing with these ideas. So this is what we would call the regular pattern ground. Those are non-sass landscapes, and these are the result of ice wedge polygons from a permafrost environment that degraded Subsequently, and I'll show you this in the model at the end, the schematic, but the when the ice wedges melted, there was some topographic lowering, and in most of the Midwest, what we see is sediment either blowing in or washing into these areas, and we get thicker, darker A horizons in the borders. So the SAS is reversed. We've got the opposite color pattern, same shapes. So here's Champaign County, Illinois, non-SAS landscape. You can see the spider web. If we go to the Story County, out to the Des Moines Lobe, you can see the polygonal pattern ground out here between the washboard moraines. All right, so let's come back and look at the reverse stuff. That's what we're here to talk about. Again, you can see the honeycomb network. What the heck's causing that? All right, in the early 90s, I was TAing a pedology class at Ohio State, and I didn't have a project yet to work on for my master's degree. And I was teaching the air photo interpretation lab and the soil mapping lab, and I had some air photos from dark in Miami counties in western Ohio, and I looked at them and I saw this polygonal pattern ground on it, and I thought, what the heck is that? I go up to my office. Dr. Kay Everett, who's with the Bird Polar Institute, had just come back from the North Slope of Alaska literally the week before, and he was putting a Pingo poster up in the hallway. His office was right next to mine. And I showed him the picture. I said, what are these? And he pointed to his Pingo poster and he said, you've got ice wedge polygons. Where are these from? I said, well, they're western Ohio. So he thought, oh, this is cool. So I go on a field trip the next year, Midwest Friends of the Pleistocene, up to Beewawick, Minnesota, take my pictures with me there. Hilt's on the trip. Show him to Hilt. Hilt says, take a look at this. He's got his QR paper, the manuscript, with him in his briefcase. So that's how I got started on this, and then Sam and I ended up together here somehow. So here's Hilt's map from 91. He looked at where these paraglacial features occurred in the Midwest. He had a southern limit of permafrost based on his air photo interpretation at about this blue line. We'll come back to that at the very end of the talk, and we're going to push that line farther south. And then the purple, is where we're mapping the SAS at. So Hilt wasn't looking at SAS at that time. He was looking at these permafrost features. If we go back another decade, Payway's map, question mark down here across the southern Illinois area, not much evidence at the time. So Hilt had worked on it, I worked on it, a few other people worked on it. So let's go up to the North Slope of Alaska in a modern permafrost environment, and let's go to the continuous zone up here in the red, continuous permafrost. You see these ice wedge polygons, they're the same morphology, same size, dimensions as what we see in the pattern ground in the Midwest. And the way these form, freezing is a desiccation process. The ground cracks open, fills with water, the water freezes and expands, so these ice wedges start to grow over time. So when would the climatic conditions be right? Well, in modern environments, it takes about a -4 or a -6 mean annual air temperature to get ice wedge polygons to form. So if this pattern ground is in fact relict ice wedge polygons, we know it had to have been permafrost in Illinois. We know the mean annual air temperatures were about that at the time of formation. Well, when could that have happened? Well, it's very much related to the position of the ice margin about 18,000 years before present, and then as it melted back, we had tundra conditions out beyond the ice margin. If you look at the modern distribution of pattern ground, the polygons are pretty much restricted to 0 to 2% slopes. Once you get anything sloping steeper than that, you get different forms, strings and nets and different patterns that form. So in map view, here's the polygons that occur on these planar landscapes. We can go to the modern Arctic and we can see the polygonal pattern ground. In our SAS areas, we also see some of these circular, what are thaw lakes today, but we won't talk about that in this paper, but we see some of these circular patterns with the polygonal patterns in the area of SAS. All right, so what happened in this area? Well, as Sam mentioned, the Sangamon geosol is an important part of the story. We've got, at the time, the ice margin is at the building the Bloomington Moraine just north of our area of SAS. We've got Farmdale soil developed in Roxana on top of the Sangamon geosol that's in the Illinois episode Diamictons. The ice wedge polygons form. It takes several hundred, maybe a few thousand years these things form. Climate warms, permafrost in the region melts. So now what we end up with are these essentially pits where the ice wedges actually used to be. Now what happens is eolian material can blow into here, or material can wash and slump into these areas. So one of the themes that keeps coming up in all the sodium literature is this low permeability zone. Well, if the Sangamon is pretty uniform throughout this area, how can we post-Sangamon time modify the Sangamon so that we get differential permeabilities and get water to start moving and creating SAS and non-SAS? So this is probably the time where we had ice wedges moving into the Sangamon. If we go to the modern Arctic and we look at some decaying ice wedge polygons, you can see the ice wedge would have been located in the pit area right here, forming a political network, and material now can slump and wash in. So now we're starting to get things that maybe were dense, low permeability, are slumping in. We're changing the permeability of the Sangamon and the zone adjacent to it. Peoria silt now, as the permafrost is degrading, this part of Illinois is getting dusted by Peoria loss yet. As the ice margin melts back all the way up to about 12,500 BP, we're still getting dusted with loss. So we fill in those troughs, and they all didn't look exactly like this. And then post-settlement, we come in with tillage equipment, and we drag discs and field cultivators and things across there, and we take our microtopography, and we just get rid of the last 10 or 20 or 30 centimeters that were there prior to settlement. So taking a step back, when we go to these paraglacially modified landscapes, this is the western Ohio area I worked in. It's also a billiard table, flatter than a board there. We see this incredible soil diversity. Well, it's got to do with these paraglacial features. And one of the things I'll show you in a second is from Larry Wilding's PhD work, the variability in soil horizonation across his SAS areas that he worked at. So here's a pit dug in my master's thesis across one of these polygons, and I just want to show you the variability in the A horizon thickness. Here's the solum thickness. It's highly variable across this, again, planar landscape. We've got water that's reducing material here and not here, so we had different permeabilities. Actually, the water was moving laterally through these trenches that we had dug. So I think we can create the differential permeability within the Sangamon. So if we go to Dr. Wilding's drawings out of his dissertation, this for scale, this is 1 foot. So a little bit of exaggeration here. But you can see the E and A waviness across here. So I think some of that is due in part to what we see left over from these paraglacial features. Now, not all of these ice wedge casts or these troughs are created equally. If we go different places in the Midwest, they're filled with different materials. Loess, Aeolian sand. Some don't have any windblown material, and that material slumps into them. Here's some in Wisconsin that I've worked on. You can see there's the infilled with windblown sand. So you've got a wavy lithologic boundary, and then we've got the BT that's wavy across there, and it's due to soil formation that's been controlled by these paraglacial features. So to finish things up here, the timing of this happened while the ice margin was located down here building the Bloomington Moraine and shortly after. Hilt's southern limit of permafrost was there. We want to push it farther south based on our SAS and where we see ice wedge polygons or relict ice wedge polygons on air photos. So some of the SAS we think is related to these paraglacial features, not all of it. All roads lead to Rome. Well, I paraphrased it, more than one road leads to Rome. We can get SAS soils, different pathways, but we think this is one of them. We also think it's responsible for the horizonation, the wavy horizonation that we observe. We can push the southern limit of permafrost farther from the ice margin than we previously thought. I think if we start thinking about these geomorphic processes, these landscapes aren't as random as we initially thought. There's a pattern to it. And then 5 and 6, did the ice wedge polygon formation and degradation lead to the differential permeabilities in the Sangamon? And did it lead to the subtle topography that Sam needs to drive his hydropedologic processes? So we're field testing these ideas. In a year or two, come back. We'll tell you how wrong we were. So thank you.
No,
I haven't. I've looked at them from northern Wisconsin all the way down to almost Carbondale, Illinois, and I think it depends on the host material, how big the polygons are. I don't see any morphometric differences based on distance from ice margin or anything. Okay, Carolyn?
You know, that whole area, even
is ancient history for me. I know what you're talking about, but Mike focused on the Springfield.
There's something. Why is the Springfield Plain so flat compared to the Mount Vernon and the other areas?
It may be due.
One thing I want to mention is, I don't know if you remember, but that whole area is mapped as Illinois itself, but how many of those holes that we drilled and backhoed it actually had Illinois itself? Very little. So that eastern area may be eroded, and that may be the difference, even though it's mapped as Illinois itself. The Illinois still may only be in the area next door concentrated.
Yeah, and what we find may support that.
So I really would like to see a new boundary for the Illinois Still. I mean, this current
approval. I have some friends at the Illinois
Still. We'll get Brandon Curry and Dave Grimley on that.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. We have to actually move on now. Sorry, folks.